This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what will it take to defeat ISIS or the so-called Islamic State? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Despite its recent defeat in Ramadi, Iraq, the terrorist organization still holds large swaths of land in Iraq and Syria and is inspiring terror around the world, from Paris and San Bernardino to Istanbul and Jakarta. Many counterterrorism officials regard the Libyan branch as the Islamic State's most dangerous affiliate, one that is expanding in territory and continuing to mount deadly attacks. The United Nations says in a new report that Iraq's war with Islamic State militants led to more than 18,800 civilian deaths and more than 36,000 wounded between January 2014 and October 2015. In a recent meeting in Paris, six allied defense ministers agreed to step up their military campaign against the Islamic State. Recently, Iraqi forces backed by U.S. coalition airstrikes drove Islamic State out of the city of Ramadi. Other airstrikes have been destroying extremist oil trucks, a key source of revenue for Islamic State. But even as defense ministers who are set to meet in Brussels in early February discuss military operations against ISIS, are concomitant political strategies being discussed and implemented as well? In Syria, many Sunni Arab states believe that the regime of Bashar al-Assad, which is backed by Shiite-dominated Iran as well as Moscow, actually fuels the growth of ISIS. In fact, evidence shows that most of the Russian-backed regime airstrikes target the mainstream opposition and civilians rather than ISIS. And in Iraq, what measures has the Shia-dominated government taken to better incorporate Sunnis, who have been marginalized since the fall of Saddam Hussein, into the security forces, the economy, and civil society? Even though Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi is a U.S. ally, much of Iraq's security apparatus is presumably under the control of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, which further alienates Sunni tribes who feel victimized by both ISIS as well as Iraqi Shia militias. And to what extent does the Iran nuclear deal, which has now paved the way for the lifting of sanctions on the Islamic Republic, make it less rather than more likely that Sunni Arab states will cooperate in the fight against ISIS? Well, with us to discuss the status of the so-called Islamic State and what measures must be taken to ultimately defeat the terrorist organization are two distinguished analysts. Harleen Gambier is a counterterrorism analyst at the Institute for the Study of War. Ms. Gambier focuses on ISIS's global strategy and operations, and Nuseiba Yunus. She's resident senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. And Ms. Yunus is a Middle East expert who specializes in Iraqi politics and ISIS. Her forthcoming book, From Invasion to ISIS, Iraq, State Weakness and Foreign Policy, is due to be published later this year. And both women join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me first begin with Harleen Gambier. Harleen, I'd like to get your take on the strength or weakness of ISIS, of course, in the wake of Ramadi on the one hand, but also on the other, their apparent ability to inspire and coordinate attacks, such as what we recently saw in Paris, Istanbul, and Jakarta.
Thank you, first of all, for having me. But it's probably most helpful to actually frame conversations about how strong or successful ISIS is in terms of asking ourselves first what ISIS's overall objectives are. The group seeks to expand the caliphate that it believes it has already established to all historically Muslim lands, and then to provoke and win an apocalyptic war with the West. And so within Iraq and Syria, we see that while the group, of course, is dealing with adversaries on all sides, it is essentially unchallenged in the core areas of its terrain, and it maintains the ability both to defend its territory and to expand further into western Syria, which we've seen over the course of the past year. Meanwhile, as you mentioned, the group is pursuing regional and international campaigns both to plant these regional affiliates across the Middle East, North Africa, Central Asia, and also to inspire and direct these spectacular attacks. And so I think overall, ISIS has shown that it has the ability to be adaptive and resilient, particularly in terms of the global campaign that it's waging.
Turning to you, Nuseiba Yunus, for your take on ISIS's objectives, and you might even want to talk about its origins, who these people are, since many of them are supposedly Saddamists, those who were defeated after the U.S.-led invasion, and other elements? And to what extent do you see them as being very adaptive and perhaps resilient toward the U.S.-led and Western-led military operations against them?
Yes, Islamic State is a very strange mix of people. You certainly do have former Iraqi Ba'athists who take quite a central role in the group, particularly in terms of defining its military strategy, but also in terms of putting together and executing its strategy in terms of social control over the local populations in the towns that it occupies. And the strategies it uses, intimidation, torture, is right out of Saddam Hussein's playbook. They really take instruction from what was an incredibly secular Ba'athist regime. But those methods and that methodology has very much found its way into the Islamic State through former Ba'athist military officers, even though they were former Ba'athists, and there may have been an element of pursuing this marriage of convenience with extremist ISIS elements. I think actually now for many of them, they are true believers and core ISIS figureheads.
Back to you, Harleen Gamber, to talk more about the factors that are driving this group, these extremists who use Islam for political ends and former Ba'athists. How do you see them and their goals? And how much of a factor is this ongoing civil war in Syria and the continuing presence of Bashar al-Assad, who continues to, in a sense, leave them alone and actually go after the mainstream opposition, the role of Moscow, and now the rise of Iran in light of the Iran deal and the windfall of sanctions? How much of a factor is that?
That's a great question. I think part of the difficulty that the United States and its allies have had in their efforts against ISIS is their desire to focus solely on the anti-ISIS element of the fight, to say we are just prioritizing the fight against ISIS. And it's really incumbent upon us to recognize that even though we may not wish to be fighting many wars, we're operating in an environment where there are several different conflicts going on. There are ethnic conflicts and sectarian conflicts that are inevitably affected by whatever policy the U.S. takes. So in this case, the United States has been trying and is trying to win the support of various select elements of the Syrian opposition to convince them to prioritize ISIS above all, when actually the demand of the dismantlement of the Assad regime and a true political transition have been the top priority for the majority of Syria's Sunni population for several years now. And what we've actually seen is that to fight against that and to demonstrate himself as the only possible bulwark against terrorism, Assad has actually been radicalizing the opposition. Now, with the help of Russia, particularly Russia's air campaign in Syria, Assad has been backing the moderate opposition into a corner, actually targeting groups that the U.S. has been supporting, pushing them to run into the arms of groups like ISIS and actually, more dangerously, into the arms of Jabhat al-Nusra, the Syrian al-Qaeda affiliate.
Turning to you, Nuseiba Yunus, for your take, since we're on Syria now and ISIS in Syria, do you think that the West has a viable strategy to defeat the Islamic State group in Syria? Do you think giving priority to defeating ISIS and sort of leaving Assad alone, or more or less allowing him some sort of a temporary role, is that going to work, or should the U.S. and its allies be looking at a two-pronged or multi-pronged strategy in order to get more Sunni allies on board?
I don't think the U.S. does have a feasible strategy for bringing about a peaceful settlement in Syria. At the moment, because of our extreme reluctance to get involved on the ground in Syria and our total unwillingness to target anybody apart from ISIS, we are essentially ceding the battlefield to Russia, Iran, and the Syrian government, the Assad regime. And so what we're doing by allowing them to dominate the battlefield is we're also allowing them to dictate the terms on which the opposition and the regime can come to the negotiating table. So fine, we can have a negotiation, but if Russia, dictated by the Assad regime, gets to decide which Syrian Sunni groups can and cannot be in the room, well, that is not going to be a fair and representative negotiation process that will be accepted on the ground in Syria and that will lead to an enduring peace. In order to get an effective peace, you really need to bring as many of the armed actors as you can into the room. And with Russia and the Assad government being so picky and having the final say on this issue, I think it bodes very badly for our ability to reach a settlement in these negotiations.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Harleen Gambir. She's a counterterrorism analyst specializing in ISIS at the Institute for the Study of War. And Nusayba Yunus, from whom you just heard, she's resident senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council, a policy group also based in Washington. We're discussing the fight against the so-called Islamic State as it grows and metastasizes around the world. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You may also send an email with feedback to encounter@voanews.com. Well, back to you, Harleen Gambir, to talk now about the so-called Iraqi theater. We have seen recent success with respect to Ramadi. There's a strategy perhaps to go after Mosul, to go after Islamic State in Mosul. How do you see the state of the fight in Iraq? And again, we have to bring out the political aspect, because just as Nusayba talked about Syria, unless we see perhaps greater integration of many of the Sunni tribes, the Sunni population in Iraq, many analysts say that we really can't defeat ISIS.
I think that's true. The difficulty that we have now is that Iraq's Prime Minister Abadi, is walking a very, very narrow line. He has a delicate balance that he has to play, dealing with intra-Shia conflict with proxy militias backed by Iran that are constantly seeking ways to undermine his authority and to assert themselves as the true guarantors of security in Iraq. That is one side of it. And then the other is that he is actually still fully engaged in the fight in Ramadi, which is not over. The actual difficult work and the long-standing work of finishing clearing and then holding Ramadi remains. And I think the difficulty that we're going to see is that there actually isn't a holding force, and there isn't a Sunni holding force that is present to take that mantle. And until there is one, talking about going to Mosul actually doesn't make sense, because we've seen time and time again over the past year and a half of ISIS's campaign across Iraq that it is very adept at taking advantage of gaps that the Iraqi security forces leave, taking advantage of the overall inability of the majority of the ISF to fully defend its terrain against ISIS.
Turning to you, Nusayba Yunus, to talk about the situation in Iraq. We've had you on the program before. You've talked about the need for a Sunni National Guard, for greater incorporation of Sunnis in the government, for dismantling of de-ba'athification. How do you see progress on that front?
The Iraqi government has really struggled to make any substantive reforms that could address the long-standing grievances and concerns of the Sunni community. And the problem is that, you know, Prime Minister Abadi is really struggling to maintain his credibility and legitimacy while he is, as Harleen said, constantly being challenged by hardline Shiite militias who are very much to the right of him. So as he's trying to balance keeping his Shiite constituency with reaching out to the Sunnis, actually, he's not been able to really satisfy either of them. And that's been a real problem. But also in terms of the military fight against Islamic State and the effort to hold territory that's been cleared, we really need a much more substantial engagement with Sunni fighters. I've been to Iraq several times and I've met with tribal leaders who have between them thousands of young men who are keen to be involved in the fight to liberate their hometowns and to reestablish order there and to be involved in the reconstructing and defending of those areas. But when they approach Baghdad, they don't get an audience. The Abadi government, I think through force of necessity rather than necessarily through its ideological convictions, has not been able to really create effective alliances with potential Sunni armed fighters on the scale that we really need in order to liberate somewhere as big as Mosul, but also in order to maintain control over those areas that have been liberated. I think that's a significant downfall and shortcoming of this government. And I think although it's something that the US has hammered away on behind the scenes, there is still a lot more room for applying pressure in that regard. And I think it's crucial that that happens if we're going to see a real attempt to retake Mosul in the next year.
Harlene Gamber, does the United States have clout with this Iraqi government? Because we understand that this Iraqi government under Haider al-Abadi, while much more conciliatory than his predecessor, Nouri al-Maliki, is still really under the thumb of Iran, and perhaps even more so now with the Iran deal, which one could argue is very good in and of itself to contain Iran's nuclear ambitions. But at the same time, the sanctions relief will allow it to have a windfall. Many in the region are concerned, Sunni states are concerned, that that windfall will go toward more nefarious activities. So again, where does the United States stand in terms of its influence, and is it willing to use that influence?
Well, we were talking about difficult balances. I think this is one of the trickiest balances that the U.S. itself has to figure out. Part of the way that we ensure that we have clout with the Abadi government and to ensure that the U.S. is adequately maintaining its voice and ability to counter Iranian influence in Iraq, I think actually is highly contingent upon the military presence that we provide, as well as the political channels and the seniority of the political leadership that we ensure is in Baghdad and actually that is in other parts of the country. The inherent problem within that is that every time the U.S. increases and expands its military footprint in Iraq, we do see pushback from Iranian-backed Shia militias. And so it's an ongoing struggle, but I think part of the necessity actually to ensure that we have a government in place that we can even negotiate with and that we can work with means that the U.S. has to maintain its support and increase its support, frankly, of the Abadi government.
Nusaybu Yunus, what is your take on the Iran nuclear deal insofar as it does allow for Iran to receive these unfrozen assets? Do you think it's a net negative or positive in terms of fighting against ISIS?
I think the Iran nuclear deal in and of itself, in a long-term sense, is a positive thing in containing Iran's nuclear ambition. You know, we save ourselves in potential conflicts that could arise with Iran in the next few decades. But in the short term, it's been a negative thing. Certainly the Obama administration's obsession with bringing the deal together and with really closing this legacy-forming foreign policy piece, he has neglected to really tackle Iran's extremely damaging and negative behavior on the regional stage in both Syria and to a lesser extent in Iraq. And I think that he's also, in prioritizing this deal above everything else, I think has undermined trust in the global anti-ISIS coalition for regional Sunni partners who could be playing a bigger role and a much more positive role than they are playing, but who feel abandoned by the US and who've chosen instead, I think recklessly, but nonetheless have chosen to tackle Iran on the front lines of the Gulf in Yemen, which, you know, they're doing because they feel threatened and they feel like they don't have the US's support in containing Iran's regional ambitions. And that's partly what's led to that disastrous conflict. So I think in terms of continuing to fuel ongoing regional instability in the short term, the nuclear deal and the run-up to it has been negative.
Well, turning back to you, Harlene Gamber, to talk a little bit about recent attacks by ISIS in Istanbul, Jakarta, and their tentacles spreading really in South Asia and, of course, Libya. What do these kinds of attacks tell us about ISIS and our ability to try to confront them and defeat them?
There are two frameworks that are implicitly underlying the debate that we're having about the best way to counter ISIS. The first is the administration's framework, which fundamentally thinks of both ISIS and al-Qaeda as terrorism problems that need to be dealt with counterterrorism solutions. The alternate is to conceive of both ISIS and al-Qaeda as insurgencies that are trying to overthrow governments throughout the Muslim world and that are also actually trying to gain terrain, especially in the case of ISIS, and establish bases and safe havens from which they inherently have the capabilities that allow them to launch attacks against the West. The first lends itself to the targeting of leadership and of the specific people that are directly involved in attacks against the West. And the alternate, I think, actually indicates to us that in order to fully address the threat posed by ISIS, you actually have to think about the capabilities that it has as a proto-state and as a military within Iraq and Syria.
So if you were sitting in the room with defense ministers or other policymakers discussing operations against ISIS, what would you recommend, Harleen, both on a military and a political level? What would be the blueprint to combat ISIS?
I love that you asked that because the Institute for the Study of War is actually engaged in a planning exercise right now to try to answer that very question. And what we've actually found after several months of reconsideration after the Paris attacks in November of 2015 was that what's actually at issue right now is a fundamental misunderstanding of the problem that is leading us to solutions that seem helpful on the surface, that is pushing us into grand coalitions with actors with whom we believe we are aligned. We're actually putting ourselves on a path, as Noseba mentioned, towards failure. And so the first thing that I would recommend is taking a step back and asking, actually, what is the nature of this enemy? And is this a terrorism problem? Is this an insurgency problem? And from there, you can get into, well, then how do we go about actually solving it?
And the last word to you, Noseba Yunus, to take a look at the expansion of attacks that we've witnessed around the world, whether Jakarta or Paris or Istanbul. What does it say, in your view, about the state of the so-called Islamic State? And how would you, if you were in a room with defense ministers and other leaders around the world, what would you advise them politically as well as militarily going forward to try to defeat this scourge?
I think that going after ISIS in the areas where it is holding territory is absolutely crucial and really is the priority. If you want to cripple this organization's ability to target the West, you want to deprive them of the immense propaganda value that holding territory and being able to export oil and having some kind of proto-state in Iraq and Syria, you want to deprive them of that. And ultimately, you know, it's the success and the waves of victories that ISIS had in 2014 that really attracted this huge following from all over the world and really revived jihadist Islamism. You know, there is nothing worse that we could do than to victimize moderate Muslims as we try to combat terrorism. Muslims who practice their faith normally in the mainstream in a peaceful way are absolutely our number one best assets when it comes to fighting Islamic State. And we need to hold on to that and build better relationships and partnerships with that community so that they can help us to prevent radicalization becoming an even bigger problem in the society.
And most unfortunately, many of the innocent refugees who have been fleeing the crisis in Syria have been demonized. And of course, that's very unfortunate. And I hear some say, you know, if we got rid of Assad, that ISIS would also be diminished. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that Assad and the atrocities he has perpetrated on Syrian civilians over the last 5 years, virtually unchecked, has been the greatest radicalizing force of a generation. People who've ended up fighting for ISIS, what they're searching for is an effective way to fight back against this monster who, without any kind of holding to account, has been able to wreak such horror and destruction on Syrian civilians. And, you know, of course, you can understand the radicalizing force that that has had. And I think defeating him would go a long way to removing one of the main sources of propaganda for recruitment.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Harleen Gambier. She's a counterterrorism analyst specializing in ISIS at the Institute for the Study of War, and Noseba Yunus, resident senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. Ladies, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Kelvin Fowler, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.